Hey, and welcome to the Hashtag Angels podcast, where we bring you conversations with the people inventing and shaping the latest tech trends. I'm Chloe, and this week I'm joined by my co-host, April.
Comms is an asset. Being able to be a part of the conversation is an asset, just like having talented people on the team is a huge asset.
We sit down with comms exec, Rachel Horowitz. She's had roles at Google, Coinbase, Twitter, and Spark. And Rachel has just taken the leap to her next big gig, which we'll talk about.
I've never taken these roles thinking life-changing things could happen. I honestly like to lead. But the minute it all kind of happened, I just thought, I want to be back in crypto.
In this episode, we explore how comms, one of the more misunderstood and undervalued areas in tech, can and should play a strategic truth-finding role in a company. We delve into the role comms can play in very early stage startups, as well as the more high wire act it plays in later stage companies. And we also talk about how to be a crypto queen. All right, let's get started.
So Rachel,
hi.
You have some news today you want to share? Is there a reason we have champagne?
So one, I've had the worst year and the best year because...
Okay.
The best part was the Coinbase exit and going public, the direct listing, and it kind of gave me chills because I was at Coinbase during a really dark period in crypto. You know, and this industry has cycles. So I entered right after the 2017 Bitcoin run. It was really exciting. Coinbase was in the news a bit. I was talking to the team about leading comms there. I called Jess a million times to say, is this crazy? But I'm really excited and it feels like a paradigm shift. And like, it feels as exciting to me as early Google and Twitter, honestly. And Jess was like, you're not crazy. It is exactly how it feels. So I joined. But then there was what the crypto people call a crypto winter. And it was hard. It's very hard on the company. It was hard on morale. It was hard work for the leadership team. Anyways, so many ups and downs. And as you guys know, also it was a growth period for Coinbase when I was there. It's like exactly like Twitter, 300 people to over 1,000 in under a year. So it 3x'd in size. So for me, I left only because 2 years at Coinbase truly felt like, and I can talk about all the reasons I wanted to go to Google, but it was a lot of hard work. And so I just left hoping and praying that the space fulfilled a lot of its promise and thinking over the next like 2 to 5 years it would. I think 2020, I did not see that coming. And so the fact that all these neat things came together, the Coinbase team got their moment, but also, you know, NFTs and Bitcoin, like all these cool things were happening. So it was a really exciting year. And for me, it definitely changed my life. I mean, I've never taken these roles thinking life-changing things could happen. I honestly like to lead. You know, when you work at small companies, you get to be not the middle manager, you get to be the leader. So to me, that's all really the appeal. So this worked out really well. But the minute it all kind of happened, I just thought, I want to be back in crypto. And I thought I want to take some time to hang out with my family because this year was so hard. So I actually resigned from Google. And then my intention was to go talk to all the crypto people I know to say, I'm around and I'd love to start advising founders. But one thing led to another with Katie Hahn and Chris Dixon. And we realized that the crypto fund at Andreessen and that team is the right place for me and the right platform. And it's all the things I wanted to do, particularly on the policy front. I thought about this as I was thinking, what can I do? I don't know if you guys saw there was like a crypto council launched. A bunch of folks are going to advocate for the space among regulators and policymakers. And I feel like I have so much to offer in that sort of fight or that campaign. And I really wanted to get involved with that in addition to advising. And it just turns out that Andreessen, it's the perfect platform for me to do all of that. So yeah, I'm taking the leap and joining the team and I'm really excited. So what a whirlwind, what a year.
Congratulations. This is news to me right here on the
pod.
So this is very exciting.
Thanks, guys.
They're so lucky to have you.
I'm so excited. I'm so excited.
Tell us about your path into being a queen of crypto. Like when you first heard about Coinbase, like what did you know?
Yeah.
And how did you evaluate that opportunity given like that it was new and also it was new to you?
Think about it this way, you guys. Remember when we were at Twitter? Like the whole world was watching the consumer web. that was the main thing, and that was changing the world. I always think it's interesting because that's about when Occupy Wall Street was going on, and that's about when the Bitcoin white paper dropped. And so we were all part of another kind of revolution, technology revolution. Mm-hmm. And while we were kind of running that direction, there was a whole other group of nerds getting really excited about crypto and what it could all mean. The first time I'd really noticed that this was getting a lot of attention, I read some articles when I was at Spark Capital and they were investing in Coinbase. And I looked something up and I saw a report that said Bitcoin was one of the top three brands in the world. I think for a lot of people like Brian Armstrong, early people thought they were even late to it. I felt like I was really late to it. But I think most people right now would say it's just such early days. So I think every time you discover crypto, you probably feel late, only to discover we're still in like very early stages. So it's all good if you're just getting in now.
What was it about crypto and Coinbase in particular that drew you in? And I think it would be helpful for people to know more about your general sort of background and your context around, like, for instance, you know pop culture deeply and love it and understand it and love to be a critic of it in all sorts of interesting ways. So I think let's give people the full journey of where you started to Coinbase.
Well, I technically started in politics, internships in college, and then my first jobs out of college was at a Democratic consulting firm called GM&B. And while I was working in politics, kind of entry-level campaigns, writing speeches, also philanthropy work, I became enamored with technology like everyone else. Speaking of pop culture, Google was public, I believe, and on Oprah as the best place to work. That's how I was making my life decisions at that point. I was like, I need to get down there, be part of this. It's hot. And Oprah cares
about it.
Yeah. 25-year-old Rachel is going to California. So I did. I got a job at Fleischman Hillard. The big client there was Zillow. It was Rich Barton is launching April. And we had to fly to Seattle. And I was so entry level and new and coming from politics. I'll never forget the team was like, you need to build a media list and make sure Michael Arrington is on it and Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher. And I was like, for sure, no problem. And then I had to go Google who are these people. So every time people ask me for comms tips, I'm like, just nod and then go Google it and it'll be fine. So we launched Zillow. I was nodding and pretending like I knew what was happening, but it went really well and that I learned so much from that team. And then another agency called Cutline was hiring to fill roles at Google. April, you were there at the same time. It's like 5,000 people. Mm-hmm. I think the comms team was trying to scale. That's when the team hired like 100 new grads. So I was super embedded. I rode the bus down from San Francisco and I was there the day Google acquired Rightly, and that turned into Docs. And I was pitching the Wall Street Journal on this idea of collaborating in the cloud. And they thought it was crazy. We would only ever use Word Doc. And this Google Docs thing is nuts. And so, Chloe, to answer your question, YouTube had just been acquired. And I was obsessed. And I begged every superior of mine, every manager, to let me transition over to the YouTube team. And eventually, because I was just like, oh my God, this is where politics and culture and everything meets what I now know and love, which is the web. And it's so neat and so cool. And it just felt like YouTube touched everything, everything in culture. And that was one of my first, I think, epiphanies that, and this is what led me to Twitter, even from a comms perspective, I'm so tired of pitching red herring and tech crunch. I'm going to try my hand at like style desk people and fashion people and people writing tips for moms at home and movie people. I think technology is a big story. It's not a tech story. It's just a story that's touching all our lives very quickly. And so that was really fun. And a couple detours here and there to some side gigs writing for Buzz Sugar. And then our friends, including April, were at Twitter. And I got a call they had one open head on this tiny little comms team. And Carolyn Penner said, you should throw your hat in. Oh my God, it'd be so fun. We can work together again. I remember in that interview, and everyone was like, why do you want to work at Twitter? And I was like, because like culture is happening and Twitter is at the center of that. And I think you guys had just had Snoop Dogg had just come through with some marijuana in the office, mm-hmm. Kanye. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I mean, again, 29-year-old me was like, that seems awesome. Sign me up. Like, my parents were like, how's this going to monetize? What's then? I was like, Snoop Dogg was there. And all my friends from Google. They're like,
do you know how long they waited for Lady Gaga to show yeah. up? Like, I gotta go.
This is hot. So I didn't analyze any kind of business. I don't think, but very passionate. And then Chloe had just, this is all my fans. This is how I've been like a fangirl of all of you guys for so long. Chloe had just been on the cover of Fast Company.
Oh, gosh. Like, that was a fun party to celebrate her cover story.
And that was the media Twitter narrative. And I was just so young and still kind of – and I had all these great skills that I'd learned at Google that I – but I kind of felt like this is my opportunity to try to stand out and lead on something. And I was like, if I could just get close to that Chloe Slatin, I could show her –
I'm gonna make her mine.
Yeah, she can trust me with that narrative. I'm gonna do it. And yeah.
Well, I want to tell you, Rachel, I don't know if I've ever said this to you or told you what a huge and important part of my Twitter experience you were. Your partnership and belief and allyship, you know, at Twitter was amazing. It was like, I could not have done what we did, I mean, without you specifically. And it this is a part of Twitter that I always find so fascinating that I think is part of the tech world and this merging that you're describing of how what used to be a niche tech world is now just technology is a tool and a language that affects every single corner of our lives. But like my work inside Twitter was harder than my work outside of Twitter, right? Like the media world, the news industry, celebrities, poets, anyone in a creative space, we were able to reach and convince about the enormity of what it meant to have this interactive platform at their fingertips. But convincing Twitter that it was actually a new form of media company internally was extraordinarily hard and is still part of its journey of figuring out where it plays in this space. And back then, being a media company was a dirty word, and it wasn't like, you know, it had all this unnecessary baggage when, you know, it's like, clearly this is a media company with a different kind of business model, and but with all the same creativity and technology at its core. Anyhow, having an ally inside the company who just got that deeply to its core was so empowering, and it just made the whole journey of a wonderful, but as we also know, Twitter was a very intense journey, but you were seriously like a shining light there wonderful folks to work with. I loved it.
It was so formative. I mean, back at you, because you were my idol, and so was April, and so was Jana, and so was Katie. And I mean, it's funny because April and I are literally the same age, but like, she's who I want to be when I grow up. And like,
you're a crypto queen. Oh, I mean, like, well, like, let me be one of your ladies in waiting or whatever in the crypto landscape.
I knew
landscape.
I'd get there someday, like, but you guys were my blueprint, and I kind of got to fly. You guys were in these like leadership positions taking arrows, you know, the failures were yours, the successes were yours. I got to fly right beneath that and really observe. I cannot tell you, I was a sponge at Twitter. I mean, I literally soaked up every room, every deal I was in with April, Jana and I on the phone, Chloe in the room with other execs at Google. Like, I was just like absorbing all of it. And that's actually what made me really want the Coinbase job, actually, crypto aside, because I was like, I got to be a director on that ride at Twitter, and I had really great leaders who were like, I had all this confidence in that knew what they were doing. And then I was nodding and being like, same, I totally know what I'm doing, when it was, you know, still faking it a bit. But I can't tell you, like, everything I did at Coinbase that helped me like earn trust with the founders and the management team and get a function off the ground. I'm telling you guys, I was pulling so many case studies and lessons off the Twitter shelf that probably most of you can't remember, but they were filed away. And I was like, this is what's going to make a CEO comfortable. Like, all of the internal comms I can pull from that. But Chloe, to your point about the media narrative, when I think about like writing down moments in my career that meant something to me, and especially in comms, I'll never forget, we had the X Factor coming to America with Simon Cowell. And he was, you and the team were so innovative, and you had convinced him to leverage Twitter as the platform to actually let the audience participate and vote. Mm-hmm. So we were all working on this, and I thought it was so neat. And I had just seen that Page One documentary with Brian Stelter and David Carr. And I was obsessed. See, all of my career success goes to me being like such a thirsty, sad fan that gets obsessed with people and then just tries to like get close to them. So I was like, Brian Stelter, I love him and he loves Twitter. What a great, and he's like the media reporter. So I just cold emailed him and said, maybe he'll pick up from Twitter, and said, I am on Twitter comms. I think Twitter and TV is like a story. It's happening. And actually, I have the perfect news hook for you. Simon Cowell will probably talk to you. I had no idea if I was going to go ask Chloe. And you should write about this because it's a really great example. And he wrote back and he goes, that's cool. Yeah, I'll do it. And I was like, and so then this was my, I was like, had been working with Chloe, but I hadn't really put Chloe up for a big moment like this for a project that she was attached to. And I read everything Chloe had ever said. I read every email she'd ever sent about this partnership. I listened to every interview. This is a comms tip too. And I cut and paste and I put it all together in a doc into a talk track for this interview. I'll never forget. I was up till midnight, like getting this just right. Cause I felt like if this will only go good if Chloe feels she's in good hands, and this will only go well if when we get on the phone, we have one chance to basically dictate this story, like to nail this narrative to Brian Stelter. And I want to frame it up and show Chloe the logic of what I think, how we unfurl all her great talking points into a coherent story in this context. And I gave that talk to Chloe, and then we prepped, and you were so thankful, and it went really well. The story was awesome. It ended up getting Chloe and Katie into Vogue too, which is another story, but because they saw your cheekbones in the photo, Chloe, and then Vogue called.
Did you sneak that into the talk track? You were like, and by the way, I have amazing cheekbones.
No, yes. It was like the picture, the main picture above the fold was Dick, but then Chloe was like a tiny square. Right. And I was like, oh, those Vogue editors are going to like this. They're going to want to see this. So I later got promoted to director, and it was because Chloe pounded the table for me. You revealed, and you just said that the diligence that went into that prep, you just really appreciated it. But what I always take away from that, and to your point about allyship and women seeing each other, you saw the hard work. And I don't know, I just felt seen because Chloe saw it and appreciated it. And then she rewarded it. And I felt like I didn't have to swagger. I didn't have to pound my chest. I just had to do really good work and stick the landing. Mm. And Chloe rewarded that.
I love hearing that story back. But I do want to underscore one thing, which is when I was pounding that table, what I remember, besides the fact that you prepared the crap out of that interview, was that you're just fucking smart and brilliant when it comes to taking technology and turning it into an accessible story. It's to me, it's like literally a form of product insight that you have, which I just want to acknowledge that, yes, you do a lot of hard work, but you're also just, you have this inability to understand technology and tell a story around technology that is incredibly digestible to the people, the end user, but it's also illuminating to the people who are building that product. And so it takes me to this question. I want you to walk us through, I think comms is misunderstood in the tech world and undervalued deeply. And I want you to help us understand, like, what is the role of comms? And then maybe we can walk through the role of comms at a startup pre-product market fit where people aren't thinking about comms, but I actually think it can be a really strategic advantage depending on the business, all the way through to, you know, the incredible cycles we went through at Twitter when you're hyper growth and you're having they love us, they hate us moments as you kind of become the flavor of the month and go through the cycle.
You know, I used to think in my early years at Google and even early, you know, the Zillow stuff, I thought comms was media relations, right? Just earned media is super useful. It's free. It's third-party validation, which is powerful, especially in the early days. And it's channels. It's amplification. You don't have to pay that much to get people to raise awareness about who you are and what you have to offer. So I thought in the early days, I probably would have defined it pretty specifically as like publicity. Like, you just want people who are really smart about figuring out how to understand what reporters want to write about and what you'd like them to write about, and finding ways to meet them in the middle and working with the product team and exec teams to like find those hooks. But I think the world, because of everything we did at Twitter, because of Facebook, because of the internet, the world has changed. There's this whole new conversation around going direct and content creation and owning your own channels. The rhetoric is very heated, but it's not all wrong. Comms is literally, what is your truth? What is your story as an organization? What are you trying to do in the world? What are your first principles? Like, all the things that are like, answer the why of your existence, and then shipping it. And you're shipping it to the employees who work at the company. You're shipping it to the board. You're getting that message out to customers, to users, to individuals who influence the customers and the users and the decision makers. And then, of course, journalists and policymakers, right? It's like the list goes on and on in terms of the audiences. So I think of it very purely as like, what is the truth of what you're doing? And what is the answer to why? And how do you just go tell that story? And if you have an authentic, everyone on the team is aligned, you've actually put it down on paper, and as you layer new pieces on, you're talking about why, and you have a comms team or a comms leader who's fitting that into the narrative. To me, taking that to market, whether it's to your own employees, whether it's through your recruiting efforts, or whether it's through the press or through social or through paid media, that's the fun part. And a really good comms team lands that for you. They land it with employees. They're strategic and thoughtful about landing that with the right audiences and when, and sequencing it. I think we can all acknowledge that a lot of tech journalism is sort of reflexively negative these days, right? It's not necessarily going to carry the water for tech anymore the way they used to, honestly, in the start of my career. And I think that Brian Stelter piece would be very difficult in today's environment. He would agree, because they see tech as very, very powerful. And so their role is mostly to check that power. That's just a fact. It's not a value judgment. I don't know if it's good or bad or whatever. I wish there were more optimistic outlets, more kind of outlets that were inspired by builders and technology. But And there will be. I think there's a big hole there and there's a vacuum, and folks will probably figure out they should fill it. I think Substack's going to fill that in some ways. But that actually doesn't matter to me. And I think part of navigating Coinbase, for example, I mean, talk about a establishment that is not interested in crypto messages, right? Like, a lot of journalists covering crypto, this is changing, which is kind of fun, but a lot of journalists covering crypto, when I was at Coinbase, they've been covering consumer finance their whole careers. So they're not covering this as a technology. This is like a buyer beware story in their eyes. So this was a whole establishment set up to not necessarily be all that receptive to the message. Again, it doesn't matter, because if the truth is good, if the story is there, if what you're trying to build and accomplish and what you're doing for your customers is good and all that stuff, I think it's the role of comms to just find ways to tell that story.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I've always admired about the comms function, and, you know, got the opportunity to work with you and the whole crew at Twitter, and then had an amazing partnership with my partner, Julia Blystone, at Slack. And just recognizing that there's this one portion of the storytelling that you do for which the conduit is through a human being.
Right.
And like, human beings have their flaws and have their good days and their bad days. And just that story you tell about the way you prepped Chloe and reflecting on, you know, all the just really honest and supportive partnership that I felt during that work at Slack with Julia, of really feeling like she was coaching me and how I showed up in the world at the same time as she was helping prepare me to be a conduit for the core messaging for Slack. And so, like, can you just talk about that a little bit? Like, that's very unusual in the rest of tech world. Like, I build product and, like, I don't have to run the mobile app that we build through a human being to, like, as the final pass. But that's so core to what you guys do. And I'm sure there are upsides, but also, what a challenging medium to work with.
That is true. You're right. It's, I mean, can you think of a more subjective role in all of tech that is like full of EQ, especially, and what I have found to be fun, I mean, it's engineering culture, it's product culture, it's data driven. So I love breaking these challenges and opportunities down to their like component parts for stakeholders. I think when I started out, it was like, what? Why am I? This is so obvious. Like, don't tweet that, you know. And now or people are like, well, we want to announce this. It's going to be loved by everyone and positive. And you're like, no, it's not, you know. And I think a lot of young comms people start out rather combative and sort of with a bias to know. And when you lean into the fun of the human part, April, to your point, where you're like, all of you people are my sandbox. And I'm going to find the ones, some of you are great in front of employees. Some of you are not. Some of you
have cheekbones.
Some of you have cheekbones and you're going in Vogue and you're doing it for the cause. Some of you are wonderful on stage. Actually, there's some people who aren't really meant to be out front as the spokespeople, but they are the best partners for getting to the heart of the thing that you're trying to talk about. When I was at Coinbase, I was joking. I was like, it's kind of, I don't know. My best friends here are 24-year-old dudes and I'm 40 and a mom. And like, like this generational, but because I could sit them down and say, okay, the exec team thinks this is the story, but talk me through for real how this thing works, because I don't think that's how this thing works. And they'd say, no, they're sort of right and they're sort of not. Here's what I would say. But I think in comms, you're totally finding the conduits. You're finding actually the content. Like, I think it's just as important for comms people to dig in, sit in meetings, hang with the builders, the people who are actually making the stuff, get them talking about it. It's all there. You rarely have to, I think, write stuff down from scratch, honestly. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. Like, some PM has a really great couple of slides. That is the story. And the best part about comms that I've just like, I love it. I've just grown to love it is you just get to look at all this, these ingredients and all this content and all these pieces laying around. And you get to cut and paste it into the doc and say, yeah, I know we love to talk about this part amongst ourselves. We're very enamored with this. But that's not the story, actually, when we go to market. Like, it's just these three lines is really it. So bedside manner is totally a part of the gig, you know? And people have to feel like they're in good hands. So I think credibility, whether it's you're new in a role or you're new working with a team, I think there's a lot of roles like this. But in comms, you only get a few early at-bats. And if you take an exec out and they do an interview or they're in front of employees and you didn't think of the question that they were going to get asked live on CNBC and they feel they didn't have a good performance, charitably, I'm sure they'll give you another chance. But really, I actually feel like there's a very little room for error when you're starting to build trust and credibility. That's why I think diligence is so important. A lot of attention to detail, like over preparation. And that's why I think comms people have to be glued to Twitter, have to read every newspaper in the morning. So that we recently put the president of commerce, Bill Reddy, at CNBC to talk about shopping and Google. And his first question was about crypto, obviously. But if you're just buried in your work, you would never have, we wouldn't have been, but we prepped him for it. He was ready. Good. It's a high wire act. And yeah, you can lose trust very quickly. It can be a little bit brutal. Yeah.
I just also have to give like a quick shout out to like the personal carer and like in the caring personally about the person you're working with. I mean, which I'm just recalling when I returned from Slack after having my son, Sam, I returned after 12 weeks. I had just been named chief product officer. And then about a month in, we got a great comms opportunity for me. One of those ones, like, you know, where you're in some fashion magazine that I used to read as like a kid that was not going to be a model. And then you're like, how did computers lead me to this moment where I need to figure out what to wear to be in this women's magazine or whatever. And I felt like shit in my body and I like couldn't, I had nothing to wear and I could not bear to even spend my weekend like going to face that.
Yeah.
And I almost get a little verklempt thinking about like Julia, my comms partner, like she wouldn't take care of that for me. You know what? Like she showed up at my house with six dresses, all of which I would have not wanted to have seen the price tags for because she just like made it so that I didn't have to think about that and was able to just focus on showing up and doing my job. And, you know, that's not normally part of the job. Yeah. That's a different job. But I will say, like, it was what was needed for me to be able to do my job in the moment. And man, it takes so much trust to be able to like let somebody do that for you, and also for somebody to know how to do that. I'm sure there are a lot of stories like that between comms leaders and their exec partners. But that was like, for me, it was just like, oh, I'll never, comms, you know, that'll always have a special place for me.
Oh, that's so great to hear. And I think comms people, you kind of get trained and you build up this, I think, intuition. It sounds like your partner at Slack had, which is, I just have to make everything okay so that this goes well. And they just, they need to feel like they're in good hands and they can show up and they're going to feel great and it's going to go really well. And I'm on it. All the sausage making, I'm on it. And it should be really clean. Yeah. And I just think that's excellence. For startups, a really interesting insight, I think, that I had at Coinbase was comms people know everything. I always say to teams I lead now, don't be the most gossipy person at the lunch table. I mean, I had to learn this. I've now locked it up because I've learned this the hard way. But when you are, you actually lose confidence that you're someone who's going to keep it professional and keep stuff confidential for, you need that trust. I think when you're at the management level, you guys know politics can break out. Execs need to know that no matter who's mad at each other or who's jockeying for what, or things can be really wonderful and kumbaya. Things on executive teams can get really Game of Thronesy really fast and it changes overnight. You always have to establish yourself as Switzerland. They'll never think Rachel is roped into any agenda, that the comms team and the leadership is doing the right thing for the business and is going to stand by that. And you kind of have to establish that right up front in order to like gain trust. So, and then people tell you stuff, you know, and people bring you in. And before you go out, maybe you're going to put someone on, in front of the Wall Street Journal. I've had many people say, I've had a nasty divorce. If I go out, will this happen? You know, or some people say, this isn't actually my real name, because I've like people really confide in you and it's to the grave. And I think your reputation, you have to really instill, I think, build a reputation that you're going to hold these secrets and be professional about it.
Another piece of that that I'd like to talk about is in a startup where you're pre-product market fit, the role of comms, because you were just describing one, that a great comms person needs to be Switzerland in the organization, especially at a later stage when it's high growth and high velocity. The role of a comms person is to really understand what's your mission, your North Star, your first principles, all that sort of stuff. Well, pre-product market fit, it's really the role of saying, does this value proposition, is it significant enough? Does it resonate? Are you all on the same page about what that value proposition is? And having a third party playing that back to you and giving you some real sort of strong feedback on whether it's clear enough, sharp enough, if it's resonating, is very, very powerful. And I think there's interesting in that role, really comms is the first step beyond your user research, but very much tied and in parallel to it, of saying, well, when you bring this out into your population and scale it down to whatever your first users are, it doesn't need to be your broad user base yet. It can be just that first very, you know, concentrated set of seed users you're looking for. Will this really play? And I think that role is really powerful. And it's rare for a company to get that feedback, I think. It'd be interesting to, if you have advice around how early stage startups can leverage that insight.
I stumbled into this on my own, but it really became very powerful at Coinbase working with Brian. He's a really big believer in clear communication and getting things down on paper. I love him for it because that's what comms wants. I can't sit in too many rooms swirling on, is our value prop this? Is our value prop that? Is this it, when we launch, is the headline this? Or is this what the headline is? Or sometimes as a comms person, I can sit in so many conference rooms or in so many Zoom calls. And I always think like, someone just needs to take the pen and we need a straw man and everyone should react. That's how we're going to get alignment. And oh my God, we will skip 17 of these meetings if someone just takes the pen. So to your point, like in the early days, I mean, it's a very good skill for founders to just learn. But if founders are coders and builders and busy with other stuff, having a friendly comms professional, someone you trust, an advisor, getting access to that, who can listen for a second, like I don't even need a whole day of immersion. I can sit in probably like two meetings. what I love to do, and Chloe, you've pointed this out before, then you think about the conversation in the media on Twitter, on Instagram, you know, like the trends in the world. And so you take what you just heard from this team about what they think is the story, what they think is the value prop. You think about what you know the world is talking about right now and what's missing. And you can just put that down on paper and get people to react in that. I think that helps to clarify thinking. So I also think there's a lot of value in a founder huddling in a room with a comms person who can, and not having a committee, not mm-hmm. having the 9 employees at the company all in it together. I love to get that circle down to like 3 people when possible. Mm-hmm. You can take teams on a journey, you can socialize things, but I just think like things get really crisp, really clear when you can get yourself in a room as a founder with someone with a comms instinct and who can help you get the ideas down on paper. But April's a great example right now, by the way, of there is this myth of you don't really need comms. You don't, and I think a lot of PR agencies and people will turn you away and say, you're not ready for PR. But April's a great example of like, market the bus. Like, and why not? I'm always like, what? Don't hate the player, hate the game. Like, if you... If you can get media before product market fit, why mm-hmm. wouldn't you get media before product market fit? I mean, it's like, mm-hmm. what came first, the hotness or the product, you know? And if it's like, if the hotness comes first and the product follows, who cares? So April has experience. She's a woman. She's a leader. She's a known entity. E-commerce is the story of the moment. I would say, by the way, e-commerce and crypto are the two most exciting things happening these days. And so April's like, trend. I can be in the press taking advantage. I can be a thought leader. I can inject my voice. That is going to help April recruit the best talent. People, when they're like, where do I want to like risk spend my life? It's going to be with Google. I always call it breadcrumbs. When April reaches out to someone and says, will you be my head of growth or my first marketing person? Or they're going to Google and they're going to see Forbes, you know, and they're going to see this coverage and they're going to see April at Zillow, and they're, it's going to give them a feeling. This is where I think I can't tell you the research. It's their eyeballs are going to send a message to their brain that this is legit and this is going somewhere. And those breadcrumbs, I think, are so important. And so I think if you have, don't let too many PR people tell you you're not ready. I think if savvy founders can figure out if I have a story here, there's a unique element here, or I have something, an insight to add to the conversation around NFTs or influencers or whatever it is, or the e-commerce conversation post-COVID. And so I want a team that can get me in there using their relationships mm-hmm. to have that conversation. So I'm all about that publicity.
Comms is an asset. Being able to be a part of the conversation is an asset, just like having talented people on the team is a huge asset, like just like having capital in the bank is a huge yep. asset. And then obviously having customers and revenue and actual product market fit.
Yep.
But and not to say that they're all created equal, but yeah. I'm of a mindset to use every advantage you have available to you. And I absolutely credit, you know, Stuart's, I think, incredible. Stuart Butterfield at Slack, he has incredible instincts and is very good at media. And I got the opportunity to sort of grow up in my own experience around doing media and around just how to even think about using that tool a lot during my time there.
Yeah.
So I always try to use it to further the cause and the mission. And if you're working on something that is helping people, then you kind of, I think, feel more justified.
Totally.
In deploying those tools.
Do it. Yeah.
So speaking of founders getting time with comms early on, what will you be doing at A16Z?
So crypto is so interesting to me because what's happening in the space is like 10 years ahead of where the story is in the media. When you're talking about, should I invest in Bitcoin or not? Is it gold or not? Like, I get it. Like, that's where the conversation is. It's hard to understand. If you get really deep into what folks are building right now, what excites people about crypto, it's so funny. Crypto people are like talking to themselves and the narrative externally hasn't caught up. And so I'm going to help, I think, these founders close the gap. I want to bring the rest of the world along with where we're headed. So like, DeFi is barely covered the way I think it needs to be covered. It's pretty earth-shattering in, I think, the consequences of the way this works. I think Uniswap's like a really important company in the space. I think if you've ever thought of working at a startup, I think NFTs is an interesting place for folks who've ever worked in the influencer space or in social media. And so how do we get that message out to normies? I'm excited. And I think it's just, I don't know. I think, Chloe, I think your role at Twitter, it was probably so fun for you to go straight into advising media, advising new social network types of startups, because you just had this really rich experience you were coming off of and you could go lend them your scars. And I feel like coming off of Coinbase, I have so much stuff to scale and share with a bunch of other crypto founders. So I'm really excited about that. But then I'm also going to really get involved. I mean, because Katie Hahn and the team there, they've also hired this wonderful leader, Anthony, and a few others. There's a really big time, I think, credible policy team at Andreessen. And I think shifting the narrative among the folks who influence policymakers and regulators is a super cool challenge. And that's, I'm going to dig into that as well.
All right. Our final question for you, Rachel. We always ask our guests here on the Hashtag Angels Pod to share one person who they admire or who inspires them or who is just like a really important person in their professional life.
Oh my gosh. Well, we went through every angel has meant something to me. So that's why I'm doing this podcast. But that aside, yes, every angel has played, it's kind of amazing, like a key role in my life at some point. It's kind of incredible. So what a gift to me. But also currently I've added some new angel types. And I would say Emily Choi at Coinbase. And Emily is, I don't know about you guys, but I look up to people who I just admire, and they're so different than me. You know, they do things differently. They respond to things differently. I don't know if I can ever be exactly like that, but I want to recognize excellence that looks a lot different than me. And that's Emily. And she's so strong. And she's just so strong. I don't know another way to put it. She has so much stamina. And we started at Coinbase as peers. She was a VP and I was a VP. And she was the one who talked me into taking the role at the end of the day. And I thought, okay, if another mom is joining, same age, this crazy crypto journey, this will be fun. We can do this together. She became my boss when she became COO. I was so proud of her. And I don't know, it was just a crazy growth ride. But the most quintessential Emily thing, I don't know, like she might kill me for saying this, but I had like a hard day or something. And to your point, Chloe, I like went into a conference room with Emily and I was like, I'm so frustrated. And this team doesn't think, you know, my team's giving them enough attention, or this team. And this person threw me under the bus and Emily just looked at me and goes, hey, you're awesome. You're doing a good job. Don't let the bastards get you down. And I was like, thanks for validating that they're bastards, number one.
I love that's what you heard.
And number two, you're right. I shouldn't let bastards get me down, you know?
And I hope you turned around, went back right into that room and said, Emily says you are all bastards.
Yeah, and they're not, but they were, you know, they were all lovely, wonderful people doing the best they could, but...
And Emily's like, no, that phrase is, that's not exactly
how I used it.
But in that moment, I was like, I don't have that voice in me that says, don't let the bastards get you down. So Emily being that voice for me sometimes is helpful. It's the kind of, I think, grit that I require sometimes that I admire in her. So, yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
She seems like such a pivotal part of Coinbase's success to somebody who is not an investor, has never owned a single Bitcoin. Anyway, I don't know. I don't know shit about it. She just seems to know what she's doing. And hats off to her.
Yes. She'll never have a big... Well, she may one day. If you're a reporter listening, you should profile Emily. She may not let you, but I'm saying
that's right. That's
she's
right.
A big deal.
Brian, are you listening?
Brian
Stetler.
Right. Oh, yeah.
All right. Rachel, you are such a treat. We are so grateful to have been colleagues with you and to get to cheer you on in this, in all of your chapters, but especially this next one. Go get it.
Thank you.
And we'll be rooting you on.
Thank you, my angels. Yeah.
That's a wrap. Thank you for listening. To keep up with Rachel, you can follow her on Twitter at Rachel Rad. Next up on the pod, we sit down with Stephen Galanis, CEO of Cameo. If you're enjoying the pod, please give us a rating or leave us a review. It helps people discover us. Or talk to us on Twitter to give us feedback. We're at #angels. The #angels podcast is a production of H Industries. The episode was produced and edited by Edit Audio, and our theme music was composed by Toby Forsman of Whipsong Music. Thank you for listening, and we'll see y'all next week.